afternoon, and thank you for joining us. Today's presentation on the Period of Purple Crying program is sponsored by the Maternal and Child Health Leadership Training Program at the University of Washington in Seattle. Our program is supported with a grant from the Maternal and Child Health Bureau with the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. This webinar is part of a series of webinars that we're doing. They're intended for health professionals working with at-risk maternal and child populations in the Northwest region and the state of Alaska. It is with great pleasure that I introduce our presenter, Dr. Ronald Barr. Dr. Barr is well known for over 30 years of research into the biological and behavioral determinants of infant behavior. Over the last decade, he has applied this knowledge to preventing shaken baby syndrome and infant abuse. Along with the National Center on Shaken Baby Syndrome, he is the co-developer of the Period of Purple Crying program. Dr. Barr is the Canada Research Chair in Community Child Health Research at the University of British Columbia, Professor of Pediatrics of the Faculty of Medicine at the University of British Columbia, and Head of Developmental Neurosciences and Child Health Research at the Child and Family Research Institute at BC Children's Hospital. He received his medical degree from McGill University in Montreal, Quebec. Thank you all for joining us, and Dr. Barr, I turn it over to you.
Thanks, Deborah. This is great, and what a wonderful opportunity, and thanks, Sarah, for connecting us this way. And I'm really looking forward to sharing this information with the people that have called in and the hopes that I will address some of their interests and maybe concerns, if there are concerns as well. As the title says, we're talking about a public health approach to preventing infant abuse and shaken baby syndrome, and specifically the one referred to as the Period of Purple Crying, which, as you heard, I've had something to do with developing. This turns out to be an incredibly timely webinar, especially for Washington State. And in the slide that I'm showing now, I note the connections or the contact points for the Washington State Abusive Head Trauma Prevention Task Force. It's headed by Carol Jenkins at Seattle Children's Hospital, and the project coordinator is Amy Owens, who's tremendously helpful. Her email is there. This is a multidisciplinary, multi-organization task force that's been put together, I believe, under the rubric of the University of Washington Governor's Office. And on September 23rd, I and Marilyn Barr, my wife, who's the head of the National Center on Shaken Baby Syndrome, went to a summit meeting at Seattle Children's Hospital, and it was fabulously motivating. This was the kickoff to try to get prevention statewide within Washington State. So it's really a great time to be doing this, and I'm glad to let you know about this connectivity. If you don't already, you probably do, but I just want to make sure that you knew about this initiative in Washington State. The other reason this is a really good time to be talking about this, and many of you may have heard of this, is that there's now a pretty well-documented increasing incidence of abusive head trauma in the face of the recession that your country and mine has been facing. This was reported by Rachel Berger, and you notice Ken Feldman's name. He's from Seattle because that was one of the centers that participated in this, and they presented this at the Pediatric Academic Society's meeting in Vancouver in May 2010. And it was titled "An Increase in Abusive Head Trauma During the Current Recession: A Multicenter Analysis," and the key conclusion was there in red, the number of abusive head trauma cases that they monitored has increased from a mean of 4.8 a month in the four centers in which they looked at it before December 2007 to 9.3 per month after. So that's almost a doubling of the incidence. So it's really timely to be thinking about prevention, and that's the topic of our talk today. Now, I can't do animations here, but I do want to show this just to remind people about what we're talking about here. This is when infants are grasped, usually under the armpits, and they're shaken back and forth. And if this animation would be able to be working, it would show that the head goes back to about here. Can you see my maybe I should do this. it goes back to about here, and then it goes forward to about here when the baby's shaken, and it's back and forth, and it's an acceleration, deceleration type of movement. There's angular velocity that's generated, and in the presence of the weak neck muscles, the relatively large head, but especially the shaking, this is what produces the damage that is typical of shaken baby syndrome and so important for infants. Now, I'm going to try to very briefly cover quite a bit of ground here, but we can break it down into the lines of evidence that contribute to the belief that prevention is timely and appropriate. And so these are the four lines of evidence I'm going to talk about, each of them too briefly, but at least enough to give you an idea. First, the knowledge that shaking your baby is dangerous. Second, that crying and colic is normal. This may or may not be a surprise, depending on your familiarity with this literature. The third is that crying and colic is the most common stimulus for shaking your baby. And the fourth is why all those three things give us the opportunity, potentially, to provide prevention. And the first is about shaking your baby is dangerous, and most people in the United States think of this as being kicked off by John Caffey's seminal article in 1972, but actually it was recognized prior to that in 1971 by a British neurosurgeon, pediatric neurosurgeon, the first one ever in Britain, Norman Guthkelch, who's now 95 years old, but he was the first to report the dangers of shaking. And ever since then, we've had a huge burgeoning literature to show that shaking your baby is probably the worst thing you can do to your infant. This, again, would be an animation, but I can't show you that. But what it shows is that when the head goes back and forth, the parts of the brain, in a sense, rub against each other, producing shearing forces, which help break the axons and initiate a cascade of responses that includes edema and swelling of the brain, which is the single most important thing that happens. And these veins also tend to break so that you get subdural hematomas underneath the skull, which is very dramatic but not nearly as important in terms of the pathology. Nevertheless, it's an important sign of this kind of damage. But the most important thing is the swelling of the brain, which results in most of the damage. Here's an example of what can happen in the retina of a child with shaken baby syndrome. This is a moderate retinal hemorrhage. This is where the ophthalmic nerve comes into the back of the eye, and all of these red spots should not be there. So you can get an idea about how damaging this can be. Here's another slide showing the damage to the retina. This is in a child who died, and the eye has been enucleated. This is the ophthalmic nerve again. This is the lens. And in this part here, which is the retina, you can see all these little spotty red spots, which shouldn't be there. And in particular, if you draw an imaginary line halfway through the equator, so to speak, these retinal hemorrhages shouldn't be there at all. This is very, very unusual. Maybe, but not necessarily, pathic mnemonic for shaken baby syndrome, but regardless, it's a very, very important sign and illustrates how damaging this shaking can be. Now, that's the cases that we know about, but what I really want to stress for you is that the issue of determining how often this happens is incredibly difficult. And the reason for that is that there are pretty clearly large numbers of cases that never come to clinical attention. Carol Jenny published a seminal article in 1999 suggesting that about 30% of the cases of shaken baby syndrome that are ultimately diagnosed were missed on first presentation and sometimes second and third presentations to emergency rooms. And many, many authors have shown that lots of cases that are diagnosed have evidence of having been repeatedly shaken and or abused prior to the time when they were actually diagnosed. So both of these kinds of evidence imply that some children are shaken and never come to clinical attention, and this is why prevention is so important. We cannot just do secondary prevention or tertiary prevention. We need to do primary prevention, and we need to do universal prevention. Now, this is a story, just to illustrate that, of Michelle and Gabby. They were two twins born completely normal at birth, and the story for both of them is summarized here. At the time they were 10-week-old twin girls, the father fought with the wife who left, The girls were being fed, bathed, and they were crying, according to the father. And Gabby, the one who ended up being most severely damaged, he said her eyes rolled back. She had weird crying. She wouldn't eat and had convulsions. And she was taken to the emergency room 48 hours later. And that seems an awful long time afterwards. And it is very typical, unfortunately, of infants who are abused as opposed to infants that have accidents. But the interesting story here, Gabby's is certainly interesting and very, very sad, is that of Michelle, because she was left with her grandmother for the week when Gabby was put in the hospital, and they had what Michelle's mother now calls a very compulsive brother-in-law who asked if she was okay when he was visiting. So they admitted Michelle, wouldn't have been admitted otherwise, to the hospital for tests on day 5, and those tests confirmed that Michelle also had retinal hemorrhages, even though she was relatively well, and a CAT scan and MRI were read in an adult hospital as normal. Now, I'm going to show you those in a second. But Michelle ended up growing up with persistent fine motor dysfunction, having difficulty with writing, holding utensils, tying her shoes and buttoning, the kind of things that you see in learning disabilities clinic that we would call mild motor dysfunction. Now, just to give you a sense, this is Gabby, the most severely damaged girl's MRI 6 months after the accident. And then even if you're not an expert at these, I think you can see that there's lots of distortion, lack of symmetry between the two sides of the brain and so on. This is the severe kind of brain damage that you get with very severe shaking. This is Michelle's CAT scan, MRI rather, and I've circled here this part here so that you will look at the space between the brain and the skull. And typically that's completely black, very much like you see here in the picture just above it. And what that should also be black in this area here. But as you can see, there's actually a kind of a gray material there, which was read now some 14 years later by our neuroradiologist here as being indicative of increased extra-axial CSF of altered signal density, which it shouldn't be, and indicative of some of altered signal density showing that there was proteinaceous materials in that area. In other words, Michelle also almost certainly had a subdural hemorrhage in that area as well. And now if you look at all the others, you will also see the grayness that is there rather than the blackness which should be there. So this was an interesting example of a girl who was only mildly shaken, but nevertheless we could document it. We would never have known this had it not been for the fact that her sister, her twin sister, was also shaken and very severely damaged. And here they are at 9 years of age, and you can see the difference in development and the range of development that can happen. So this is Gabby. She's functioning at about a 9 to 12 month old level, and this is Michelle, who had the relatively milder shaking, but nevertheless was shaken as well, functioning as a pretty normal girl. And of course they are still loving sisters, but it represents a very, very, very sad story for Gabby and a potential near miss, I think, for Michelle. So in general, of the cases that are diagnosed in the hospital, in the emergency room, and admitted, the outcomes are very, very bad. This is just a summary slide of two articles that are mentioned there. Of those that come to the hospital and are diagnosed, 20 to 35% die. Of the survivors, 65 to 80% have significant long-term neurological and developmental abnormalities, and 40% of the survivors are blind. So this is a serious outcome. In fact, it's probably the worst thing you can do to an infant is to shake them hard the way they do in shaking baby syndrome, and the outcomes are worse than almost anything else that you can do to an infant at this age. So let's move now to the issue of crying for a minute, because we're talking about, and a big part of what the basis for the Period of Purple Crying Prevention Program is to understand why crying in normal infants might be relevant to shaken baby syndrome. And there's a bunch of lines of evidence here, too, and I wish I had more time to talk about this. But first, I want to introduce you to Jack. Jack is a star of the Period of Purple Crying DVD. He is the son of the parents who are the main discussers on the Period of Purple DVD. And if I could put that on, I would show you how much crying Jack can do so that you would all hear how irritating it is. But I think most of you have probably had experience with that, so I don't have to do that part anyway. But Jack is our poster child for what sometimes in the pediatric literature is referred to as colic. And for those of you who are used to this literature, you will know that the typical assumption about the high crying of colic has typically been understood as an abnormality or something wrong with the infant. What I'm going to try to do very briefly in the next 8 or 10 minutes is to convince you that we now have tons of information and tons of evidence to show that this increased colic in the first 3 to 5 months of age and early increased crying in general are normal developmental functions for normal infants, and there is nothing wrong with the infant. So this may be a change for some, or you may have heard about some of this evidence already. So to start with that, I'm going to just take off from this article that Siobhan Gormley and I published back in 1997, in which we reviewed the literature to try to find out what the key characteristic behavioral features were of what people typically called colic, because as you may know, there's no specific definition that everybody accepts. And we argued that it came down to these three features. One is that there's an age-dependent crying pattern in infants with colic that peaks during the second month of life. Two is that there's a number of associated behaviors, prolonged crying bouts, unsoothability, a face that looks like it's in pain when it's crying. And thirdly, the third criterion was that it is paroxysmal crying, that is to say that it's unpredictable. It comes and goes for no apparent reason and unrelated to anything in the environment. Now, I'm going to only have time to show you evidence for two of these, which I've highlighted in purple, but if we had more time, I could describe all of these things and why we now understand them to be reflections of normal behavioral development. So let's talk about the crying curve first of all, and here is the very first systematic description of that, published in 1962 by T. Barry Brazelton, whom many of you may know because he's such an advocate for parents and infants and children. And this actually, people don't know, is the first article that he ever published. And he published it out of his Cambridge, Massachusetts practice, what you might call the cream of American society. And he asked the parents of these infants, these normal infants that he was following, to go home and describe in a diary the amount of fussing and crying that their infants did. And this is the result of that paper. And so this is 2 weeks of age. This is 12 weeks of age. This is hours per 24 hours of crying and fussing, and that's 5 hours up there. So what you can see here is a remarkably robust general increase in the crying and fussing and decrease in the crying and fussing over the first 3 months of life. And at the peak here, it's about almost 3 hours, 2 3/4 hours of crying and fussing for the average baby at 6 weeks of age, rather 5 weeks of age in the sixth week of life. The other thing to note about this is that there's a huge individual difference between babies. So, for example, this line here represents the 75th percentile line. That means that 25 out of every 100 babies that Barry was looking at actually cry more than you see in the graph. And, of course, this is the 25th percentile line, which means that 25 out of every 100 babies cry less.
Yes. We're not seeing which line. If you could use the arrow to point to them, that would be helpful.
I've got the arrow on mine.
You'll have to click on the screen to...
Click on it again. How's that? So this is the,
now
75th percentile line. Is that good?
Yes.
And this is the 25th percentile line. Thanks for interrupting. It was going around on my screen, so I wasn't sure that you weren't seeing it. So 25 out of every 100 babies cries less, 25 out of 100 every babies cries more. So there's a huge difference between babies as to how much they cry, but they all have this increasing and decreasing pattern of crying. Now, one might wonder whether that was also true later. And here's a study that we did in Montreal about 25 years later from Barry's. And here you see all the individual babies individually described as well. So they each have their own line. But this line here represents the mean for all of those infants. And you can see that it's very, very similar to what Barry Brazelton had described almost 25 years earlier. You can also see how variable one baby is from another. But again, the general pattern is up and then down. And this circle shows you the peaks of these otherwise completely well babies up in the range of 5 hours a day. So this is a huge amount of crying for normal babies, and it's what makes it so frustrating for the parents of these babies. So we knew that over 25 years there was little change. What I want to show you now is some evidence from the Kung San hunter-gatherers. As you can see from these pictures, what the Kung do in order to take care of their infants in the first few years of life is quite a bit different than what is typical in North America. They carry their babies with them all the time. They're in a sling, or what they call a caross, that helps them carry them around while they're gathering. In the fields, this, believe it or not, represents about 25 pounds of mongongo nuts. So these women are really working, carrying two babies plus the mongongo nuts. And we were able to get some data about how these infants cry in the face of that kind of caregiving. And as you can see from these pictures, it's quite a bit different than what we think of as normal caregiving in Western societies, where babies are often separated from their mothers. They're often on their side or their back in a crib. And I like to make the point that we North Americans are just as concerned as the Kung are about entertainment, so we make sure that there's lots of entertainment there as well. Now, you can characterize the difference between Kung San caregiving and Western caregiving along a number of different parameters. We usually do it this way. We note the difference in the contact time, which is essentially constant in the Kung San and what I've called more intermittent in Western. This includes, by the way, sleeping skin to skin with them at night and the babies breastfeed without even waking the mothers up. The carrying is constant during the day because of the sling or the caross, whereas it's more typically just in response to crying in Western contexts. The feeding is continuous. By that I mean they feed on average every 13.69 minutes for 1 to 2 minutes per feed for the first 2 or 3 years of life, which is quite different from anything even La Leche League feeding in Western societies. Their posture is typically upright because they believe it's important for development, and it's easy to do because they're carrying them all the time. And the responsivity to infant cries and frets is virtually universal. They respond within 10 seconds, 92% of the time in the first few years and months and years of life. So as you can see, this is quite a different pattern of caregiving than is typical of Western society. And if you look at these things, they effectively do, the Kung do, virtually everything that every experiment we've ever done in the West says should be soothing. So the Kung San represent a wonderful sort of natural experiment about whether or not this increase and decrease in crying is actually typical or built in, so to speak, to babies' behaviors. And here's the data on that. And as I think you can see, there's a beautiful increase and decrease in the crying and fussing, just like there was in the North American babies. And you can also see what is called the coefficient of variation lines here. And what that indicates is that the individual differences among babies are essentially the same as we get in North American societies as well. So there's the same increase and decreasing pattern, the same variability in the Kung, despite the fact that they have such different caregiving styles. And a third line of evidence is now beginning to emerge in mammalian species, of which four papers are mentioned here. They're the four papers that are extant at the moment. And what you can see is that in these four mammalian species, the infants in these species also have similar distress curves to the ones we've described in human infants. And here's the example for the infant chimpanzee distress curve. This was published by Kim Bard in a book chapter that I edited. And here's Tank, who was one of the chimpanzees that was studied in this particular study. And here you can see the distress curve for infant chimpanzees, very similar both in shape and timing to what you see in human infants as well. Now, I want to spend just a minute on the second feature, the unsoothable crying bouts, just because, as you can imagine, this is an important feature of early infant crying as far as making parents very frustrated. And this seems like a silly slide, but it's actually very important because there are people out there who claim that there's no such thing as unsoothable crying bouts. I don't think you'd say that if you'd had one of these infants, but in any case, there are people who, with good intent, want to help parents and want to say, if only you did the right thing, you wouldn't have unsoothable crying bouts. I do not agree with that statement. I do not agree with that interpretation of the literature, and I'm only going to have time to show you one argument against that. And this is a paper that was published by Ian St. James Roberts and his colleagues out of London and out of Denmark, and they looked at parents, three groups of parents. The purple bars or blue bars here, I'm not sure how it shows up on your screen, represent London mothers, that is to say, mothers who in London, England, volunteered to be in the study. The next set of bars represent Danish mothers, and the third set, the white bars, represent mothers from both societies who decided early in their pregnancy, at least by the third trimester, that they would practice what they called a proximal form of care. You can think of this as the closest thing in Western society to what the Kung San do. They would carry their babies all the time, they'd sleep with them, they'd be responsive to them, and so on. London mothers, as you know, sometimes, and quite often actually, decide to let the baby, quote, cry it out when they cry, and are not inclined to pick them up necessarily, and less likely to take them to bed. The Danish mothers are somewhere in between the proximal care mothers and the London mothers in the sense that they do tend to pick their babies up when they cry, but this is responsive picking up rather than carrying them all the time. They do tend to take them to bed with them, but it's responsive taking to bed with them and so on. So basically the London, Danish, and proximal care mothers represent a spectrum of caregiving. And what you can see here is that at 10 days, 5 weeks, and 12 weeks of life, the amount of inconsolable crying was similar in all three groups. There was no significant difference across these different, radically different caregiving styles. And you can also see that the pattern of inconsolable crying was exactly the same as the pattern of overall crying as well, which has been shown many, many times before. So unsoothable crying bouts are unsoothable, they're not responsive to differences in caregiving style, and now I want to summarize what we've been talking about, and I wish I had more time to show you even more evidence, but in summary, what we've thought about is colic is a manifestation of normal behavioral development. Colic is, we now know, the upper end of a continuum of crying behavior in normal infants. In other words, it's very much like height. Some infants are taller, some are shorter, and in the case of crying, some cry more and some cry less, but they all have this increasing pattern of crying in the first weeks and months of life. And what I haven't had time to go over with you, but there's plenty of evidence for now, is that colic is not an indication of disease in the infant. It is true that infants who are sick will cry as well, but what we're talking about here, that pattern of increased, decreased crying over the first weeks and months of life, is not due to disease. If the infant also has disease, then that can push the baby up on the crying scale, if you like, but they will still have that increase and decrease crying whether or not they have any disease. Okay, so now let's turn to the next important point, and this is the third line of evidence. Why might normal infant crying be a window of opportunity to prevent shaken baby syndrome? And here I'm going to ask Sarah if she will take us to the video clip. This is about a one-minute video clip that was produced by the National Center on Shaken Baby Syndrome along with 2020, ABC's 2020 program, and it illustrates the very important points about why this increased crying can be so devastating for infants. Can you do that, Sarah?
Yes, I'm going to close the slides and then open up the video, and when it's done, I'll open the slides
Terrific.
Back up.
Thank you.
That's what happened with this 20-year-old father who asked us not to reveal his name. We'll call him John. At 16, he was married. And within 2 years, he and his wife had two babies. By most accounts, John was a good, loving father who tried hard to care for his new family. But he says he and his young wife became overwhelmed by the expense and responsibility.
It's chaos. It's total chaos. Neither one of us was ready for it.
Then one morning, after a heated argument, John's wife stormed out of the house, leaving him upset and alone with their 7-week-old son, Corey.
I couldn't get him to stop crying. No matter what I did, I just could not get him to calm down. And I took out all my anger and frustrations that I had with my wife.
I think we should.
And my son.
This will be too tricky to get.
Picked him back forward, and I shook him 4 times like this.
But maybe you can summarize it.
And he stopped crying.
Oh, okay.
And I'll go directly to the slides.
Yeah. So for those of you who are listening, I'm really sorry that you haven't been able to hear this video. It's a very compelling story about a man that we'll call John, and ABC was able to get to interview John in prison where he had been committed, and he tells the story of how his otherwise normal child cried until he could not stand it anymore. And he actually illustrates by showing how he did it, how he shook the infant, and how obviously remorseful he is in the process of doing this. In the process of telling the story, however, he makes a lot of important points that are much more compelling if you could hear him say this by himself. But these are the points that are important as far as illustrating the connection between the crying that his infant had and the death of his infant due to John shaking. And I give John a lot of credit for being willing to go on camera and telling this story, as emotionally devastating as it is. First of all, in the story, John talks about the age of his baby, which was 7 weeks at the time, and I think from what we've been talking about until now, you can see why that 7 weeks is such a critically interesting age for the baby. Secondly, that he talks about how there was frustration over time. This is the hardest time of life, probably, for new parents for all kinds of reasons, not just the crying of infants, and all of this can contribute to increasing frustration among the caregivers of any particular infant. He also mentioned that the fact that his baby would not stop crying was the immediate stimulus for shaking the baby, and that's what I wanted to illustrate with this clip, one of the things. He says, I took out my anger and frustration by shaking him. This is an important comment, too, because it gives us a bit of an insight into the connection between the baby's behavior of crying and the caregiver's behavior of shaking the baby. And then he said something that is very critical and very special about shaken baby syndrome and how it comes about, which was, and he said, well, after I shook him, he stopped crying. What makes that so special is that it's the only form of child abuse or infant abuse that we know about that has what could be called a positive feedback cycle. That is to say, when the baby is crying and the parent picks it up and holds it under the arms and shakes it back and forth and says something like, why are you doing this? Why are you crying? What can I do to make you better, or whatever they say. And then if the baby is shaken hard enough, then the baby stops crying because it effectively suffers a mild to moderate concussion. And then the baby stops crying, and the parent or the caregiver thinks, you understand me. That's good. Because, of course, there's no mark on the baby. If the father or the mother had slapped the baby or thrown it against the wall, they could say to themselves, oh, my God, I'm out of control here. This shouldn't be happening. But when they just shake them, There's nothing negative, and indeed the baby stops crying. If they hit them or threw them against the wall, the crying would increase. So this is one of the things that many clinicians who spend a lot of time in this area feel is very, very critical, that there's a positive feedback cycle for shaken baby syndrome, but not for any other form of infant abuse. He also confesses to the shaking, which is very interesting and helpful and very convincing, I must say. And, of course, there's no associated physical contact or trauma either. So I'm sorry that we didn't get to see that. It would have been really, really compelling, but you'll have to take my word for it now, this time, apparently. So you might ask, do people really shake their infants? Is that really true? And we're beginning to get more and more evidence that it's way more common than you might think. Here's just one study, a questionnaire study from Holland, where they have maternal infant health units where the parents go, and they did an anonymous survey in these parent infant health units asking them what techniques they use to soothe their infants, and you can see that among the other techniques, 2% of the mothers said they smothered them, which means they put a pillow over the face, not necessarily smother them so much that they die. 3% said they slapped their infants, and believe it or not, 5% said that they shook their infants. This is a bit discouraging to hear that, and it's almost certainly an underrepresentation of the number who do that. And in other countries in the world, we're beginning to get evidence that shaking may be a very common form of caregiving. This is a study by Des Runyon and his colleagues in many, many countries in the developing world mostly, in which they ask a question from the parent conflict tactics scale. And for infants under 2 years of age in India, as many as 65% endorsed the fact that they use shaking as a way of disciplining their children under 2 years of age. Now, let's not pretend that every shake produces shaking baby syndrome. That's not the point here. It can be a very small shake and have no damage at all. But it is part of normal caregiving practice in these countries and is used as a disciplinary measure, and one can just imagine how that could get accentuated under conditions of stress to produce a shaking that actually was damaging to these infants. So we have very little idea about how much shaking goes on or how hard it is, but we're beginning to get that information, and what we know to date is actually quite scary. Okay, so we've talked about the danger of shaking an infant. We've talked about the normalcy of increased and inconsolable crying. Now I want to move, as we've been moving to this point, to crying as a stimulus to shaking and why we know it's so important. It turns out that early crying is almost certainly the most common stimulus for shaken baby syndrome by far. And how did we get to know that? Well, this is one of the ways. We go back to that crying curve that I showed you before from T. Barry Brazelton, and we made a hypothesis. That is, that if crying was a significant stimulus for shaken baby syndrome, then the pattern of age-related incidence of shaken baby syndrome, we argued, should be similar to the age-related properties of the crying curve. And we had two particular data sets that we could access, even though this has now been replicated three other times in other societies and other places, but we had two data sets that we could access to test this. One of them was the discharge abstract databases from the state of California hospitals via the Department of Public Health there. And we were able to take those discharge abstract databases and look at the age at which children, infants, were diagnosed as shaken baby syndrome. And here's the results of that. And as you can see, it's a remarkably similar curve for the incidence of shaken baby syndrome. And it starts at about 2 weeks of age, rises to a peak, and then declines afterwards very, very similarly to that which we saw in the crying curve. Now, one of the things about, as some of you may know, about discharge abstract databases is that there's nothing in the discharge abstract database other than the diagnosis and a couple of other facts like age, but nothing that actually says crying was the stimulus. So this is an inductive leap from the crying curve to this curve. However, it's a pretty compelling picture. Now, we did have another data set because the National Center on Shaken Baby Syndrome keeps what they call a victim database, which is populated by cases that are retrieved from the public literature, meaning newspapers, public court records, and the like. And in that data set, they also have a field where if the stimulus was crying, then that is noted. And that evidence is shown here, and you can see that these age-specific incidence curves are very, very similar to what we got out of California, even though it's a completely different data set. They still have the peak very, very early on in infant's life, and this dark line represents all the cases in the victim database, regardless of whether the stimulus was mentioned. This broken line represents those cases in which the stimulus was mentioned and was crying as the stimulus for the shaken baby syndrome. And as you can see, those two curves are exactly the same, both the subset population and the overall population. And if you superimpose the California data on this curve here, it would be almost identical. So this is pretty compelling evidence that the early increase in crying actually has something to do with the early increase in shaken baby syndrome. So here's a cartoon picture of that relationship to show that the crying curve and the shaken baby syndrome curve both start at the same time, have the same shape, have the same increase and decrease. But one of the interesting things is that in every study so far, there's been a lag between the peaks of when the crying curve occurs in the sixth week of life and when the shaken baby syndrome incidence curve peaks, usually in the third month of life. And that represents an interesting dilemma about, is that got something to do with it not being the case, or is that actually what you might expect? And this mystery, we think, has been solved now by a really important study by Lynn Sheets and her colleagues. And this is presented at the Helfer Society, and she's given me permission to use this in these talks. And what she was interested in was trying to find out whether these babies that present and are diagnosed with shaken baby syndrome actually present earlier with what she referred to as sentinel injuries that would give us some indication if we were better at diagnosing them so that we could prevent later abusive head trauma. And here's an example of a sentinel injury, a bruise on the forehead, which infants shouldn't have, and there were some were lacerations of the tongue, some were broken bones, and so on. And when she reviewed those cases and then plotted the age at which the abusive head trauma occurred, which just like in the previous ones was in about the third or fourth month of life, but then she plotted the age at which the infants had presented with their sentinel injury, what happened before they came to the emergency room to be diagnosed with abusive head trauma, that peak occurred exactly at the second month of life, suggesting that the abuse started not when the abusive head trauma was diagnosed, but when the sentinel injury occurred about in the second month of life, weeks to days in advance. So this is pretty compelling evidence that the early crying curve and that associated with the anecdotal stories, that the early crying curve is an important stimulus for shaken baby syndrome. Okay, that's the background of these three important functions here, and now we're going to go and ask ourselves whether or not this can help us provide a prevention program that might help to prevent that. And that's where the Period of Purple Crying program comes in and the Period of Purple Crying materials, which we're going to turn to now. And just in case you're wondering what that phrase refers to, here's the illustration of that. Purple represents an acronym where each of the letters of the word purple represent one of the six features of crying in the first 3 to 5 months of life that are typically frustrating to caregivers and parents. Now, we've talked a lot about the P for the peak of crying that we have been talking about up until now. The U is for the fact that this, what used to be called paroxysmal crying, that is to say that the crying comes and goes. It's completely unexpected. It's unrelated to anything in the environment. It's not related to dirty diapers or feeding. And as you can imagine, that can be very, very frustrating for caregivers. The R refers to the fact that about 10%, 8 to 10% of this crying is unsoothable crying. No matter what you do, there's nothing that you can do to start it, to stop it. You can talk to the baby, carry the baby, and it continues to cry. The second P is for the fact that it looks like it's in pain when it's crying, even though it's not. The L is for the fact that these bouts of crying are long-lasting, whether they're fussing crying or inconsolable crying bouts, and the baby will never cry as in as long bouts again ever in its life as they do now. And the E is for the fact that even though these unsuitable crying bouts can occur at any time during the day or night, that by and large they cluster during the late afternoon and evening hours between 4 p.m. in the afternoon and 12 midnight. And so these are the characteristics of crying which purple represents, and it's meant to make it easier for parents to remember, but they don't have to remember all six of them. In fact, they hardly ever do, but they all do say, oh, that speaks to my experience. I understand what you're talking about. And the other important word here is the word period, because it reminds parents that even though it might be bad now, it's not forever. This is a period of time. It will go away. And this becomes a very, very important reminder to parents who are suffering through having one of these babies. Now, we sort of have a picture of what we understand to be happening in the crying producing shaking, and so this represents one of those prolonged crying bouts, and understandably and appropriately even caregivers are frustrated by this prolonged crying, and you can imagine why that would be true, and if you've had the experience you can remember what it was like as well. And what happens for each individual person is that frustration as the crying continues and continues and continues can increase. And for any particular person, it may increase slowly or it may increase quickly. That's an individual difference. But that ultimately it turns to anger. And the key is whether the threshold for that particular caregiver is reached when they can't stand it anymore and they end up shaking their baby as a result. What the hypothesis is that we could change that relationship if we are able to give appropriate, accurate advice. And clearly that appropriate, accurate advice has to be given before they ever get to the threshold. Nobody's going to be holding the baby at 11 o'clock at night under their arms, ready to shake them and say, gee, I shouldn't do this. I saw a poster somewhere that says I shouldn't do this. So the important thing is that this information gets to them long before they're ever in that setting. And we don't pretend that this information is going to take all the frustration away. There still is going to be frustration. There may even be anger. But the whole point is that for that individual, that it never reached the threshold so that the shaking episode occurs. So that's the logic behind what we're talking about here in terms of an educational approach to trying to reduce shaken baby syndrome. Now, I have to take a minute to talk about the importance of appropriate information, reassurance, and advice, because as many of you know, in public health initiatives, sometimes things turn out producing more problems than less. And this is Jack's mother, who I want to introduce you to, and she is showing us one of the 50 different pieces of bad advice that she received when she had Jack and she was looking all over for answers. And in this particular picture, she is illustrating the fact that one of the pieces of bad advice was that they said that my baby was crying so much because my breast milk was too warm, and therefore if I cooled it down, Jack would not cry so much. Well, of course, that was nuts. It didn't work. She didn't expect it would work, but she tells a very compelling story about how much bad advice she got. And unfortunately, as illustrated here, as many of you know, there's all kinds of promises all over the internet and other places about things that will be sure to work in your baby and not result in crying. And unfortunately, these promises come without any evidence whatsoever. I review this evidence all the time. One of my favorites is this one, where you put this warmer, and then you put it around the baby, and it gives off an aroma, and the baby calms down, and it says a proven device, and the aroma is good for parents too, it says. So this is like a one-stop shopping, happy tummy device, which is supposed to work and isn't proven to work, but I can tell you that I've never seen a single piece of evidence in favor of it ever. And the problem is, of course, if we give inaccurate or inappropriate or wrong advice, the dilemma is that the frustration can get worse if it doesn't work. And that's what we illustrate here, that the frustration starts, as we've shown before, but if the particular remediation doesn't work, then the chances are that the rate of anger will go up quicker or sooner, and shaking will occur either more often or sooner than it otherwise would. So it's really, really critical that the advice be evidence-based. So in the Pure to Purple Crying program, these are the two pieces of material that it is. It's an 11-page booklet and a 10-minute DVD. The booklet has undergone way over 20 revisions. We've lost count. The film has undergone way more than 6 revisions. We've lost count. There are now over 37 focus groups, and as you can see, the materials have been translated into about 10 languages now. Each of these focus groups has given us important information about how the program is read and understood and whether or not it's helpful to parents in these cultures. Here are just a few of the pages of the program to give you an idea what it looks like. This is a grade 3 language. There's a lot of white space. It's very simple language. Explains what the Period of Purple Crying stands for. And in general, is meant to attain these goals, to be educational and attractive to parents of newborns in the first day of life, to have a clear, memorable, salient, meaningful, and positive message, grade 3 level language, as I mentioned. It's multicultural. That's valuable for all parents, whether they would ever think about shaking their infant or not. It's acceptable to public health nurses because there are no bottles, blankets, or bumper pads. It's economical. For a statewide program, it costs $2 per family, and it's critical to the program that each parent receive a copy, both to review and to share with other caregivers of their infants. And so now the question is, do these programs work? And what I'm going to do is give you a quick update on the evidence to date about the extent to which we know that they work. This represents 2 randomized controlled trials, one that was carried out in your community in Seattle, Washington, with Fred Rivara and his colleagues, one in Vancouver, Canada, published in Pediatrics and the Canadian Medical Association Journal, respectively, last March in 2009. And they were essentially the same design in both places on purpose, and they included a randomized controlled trial in which half the parents received the Period of Purple Crying materials, half the people received infant safety materials. In Vancouver, the materials were delivered by public health nurse home visitors. In Seattle, they were delivered at pediatric offices, prenatal classes, and on the maternity wards. And this was a classic randomized controlled trial. Half got one sort of intervention, half got the other, which was also a DVD and booklets as well of about the same length. And so this is a picture of what it looked like in the Vancouver trial. It was very similar in Seattle. The baby was born. The home visitor got to the home within 2 weeks, usually 3 or 4 days. At 5 weeks of age, they kept a diary of baby behavior and caregiver behavior. And at 2 months of age, they completed a knowledge and behavior questionnaire done by an independent survey firm. And here is the summary of the outcomes. There were 8 primary outcomes listed here. The ones that are colored in blue were significantly improved in both Seattle and Vancouver. The ones in orange were significantly improved in one but not the other. And as you can see, importantly, crying knowledge did change significantly, as we had definitely hoped. Shaking knowledge did too, but not significantly in Vancouver because the rates were already so high that that shaking was bad. And then sharing this information with temporary caregivers was different in both societies as well, except for the crying knowledge in Seattle. To give you an example of what that meant, crying knowledge increased significantly depending on which question you were asked. It increased from 4.5 to 22%. Parents who thought shaking was a good way to soothe an infant decreased by 63%. Walkaway behavior from the diaries increased by 74%. And sharing information increased by 9%, 12%, and 13% respectively. Now, here are the changes for each of the questions within the crying scale. But what I really want to point out to you is this. This is a Cohen's effect size, which for those of you who know it, is a way of comparing across studies to see how big an effect you get. And what this represents is the results from a meta-analysis of over 100 studies of parent knowledge and attitude changes. And the average effect size was 0.23 for a short-term study or 0.18 in randomized controlled trials. In our purple randomized controlled trial, the effect size was 0.46, so about twice as effective as is typical for this kind of education. So we were very pleased about that, as you can imagine. Now, interestingly, in this general population study, as is usually the case, high-risk parents were relatively a small portion of that group. But this study by Jill Bradshaw, which was done as a thesis in Connecticut, in high-risk mothers who are part of their nurturing families network, compared the period of purple crying and portraits of promise videos, and they randomized their units, their nurturing families network units, and did pre- and post-measures of the same ones that we did in our study. And we were actually wondering whether or not it would be as effective in high-risk mothers. And these mothers were first-time mothers. Their average income was $8,000. They were typically single mothers and so on. And in her results, as you can see here, using the same outcome measures, they had a difference in crying knowledge. They had differences in sharing it with other caregivers, but they also had differences in their own responses to crying and to unsoothable crying. So that was a pretty nice confirmation of the fact that it should work in high-risk parents, too. The other important study is Mark Diaz's study published in 2005, where he gave hospital-based parent education programs using Portraits of Promise, not the materials that we're talking about. But what Mark's study showed that it could work if it was given to parents during the maternity period. So these are the rates of shaken baby syndrome cases they had prior to intervention of the program. These are the rates afterwards. They've been able to maintain almost a 50% cut in the number of cases of shaken baby syndrome. So how that relates to our intervention is illustrated here. What is sometimes referred to the Diaz model is importantly a process model. He argues that there are important things that happen at the birth of the infant. It's a teachable moment. There's the possibility of a nurse delivering the materials, and that this is what makes his program effective. What the period of purple crying does is provides materials that parents want to hear about, and we incorporate the Diaz model as what's called dose one in the program, the period of purple crying program. And so the implementation hypothesis for this prevention program is that to make a long-term sustained reduction in the number of cases of shaken baby syndrome, we'll need to have a cultural change in the way society understands the meaning of increased crying in early infancy and the danger of shaking as a response to that crying. And there are three doses in the program. One is just like in the Diaz program, that materials are given during the maternity units. Dose two is a reinforcement of that by public health, family physicians, or nurse practitioners, or pediatricians. And dose three is a public education campaign. And importantly, everybody else in the community also has to be able to understand the importance of the period of purple crying in order to reinforce the messages that are given in doses one to three. So in summary, what do we know about shaken baby syndrome? We know an important four criteria for public health programs are met now, that shaken baby syndrome is the most severe form of child abuse. It is a preventable form of child abuse, as Mark and others have shown. It has a clear stimulus and a clear risk behavior leading to the abuse, and we have now educational materials with demonstrated efficacy in changing relevant knowledge and crying behavior, and we also have Mark's demonstration that it is in principle preventable. So this is the current status in the United States and Canada. These states are ones that have the period of purple crying implemented statewide or province-wide, and in particular in North Carolina, this is being evaluated intensely by a CDC grant, a Doris Duke Charitable Foundation grant, and the Duke Endowment, and we are looking forward in about 2012 to reporting out on the results of that. So in summary, what's good about this program is that it represents a pyramid of prevention. It's good for the general public. It's good for the parents of new families. It's good for the parents of infants who typically would have been called colicky. It's good for health care providers to provide accurate information. And hopefully it will be good to prevent the children who are physically abused and who die. So Jack and I and all future newborns, thank you for paying attention. I know this has been a bit long, but I hope it's been helpful. And here are some important websites if you're interested in learning more about it. Deborah.
Thank you, Dr. Barr. And if you have any questions, we have a few minutes here. It looks like Leanne Corville has a question, and she's from Alaska.
Oh, terrific.
Can you read her question, Dr. Barr?
I'm just looking at it. It says, okay. I work for the state of Alaska's Child Care Resource and Referral Agency. One of our roles includes education for child care providers in family child care and center settings. One of our roles is also annual training on development, including shaken baby syndrome. Is the video recommended to share with them? And Leanne, the quick answer to that is yes and no, in the sense that it absolutely is appropriate for such child care providers. It's absolutely appropriate for such education. But what is really important is that to be effective in a shaken baby syndrome prevention, this needs to be a community-wide effort. And it's really important to have at least a unit that has parents who are going to be able to be approached prior to 2 weeks of age, as you can imagine, because of the timing of the crying curve and the incidence of shaken baby syndrome. So while it's useful for everybody, we don't believe that it's going to have an effect unless the important essential components in the community are together on making this happen. So yes, it's good information, but we don't expect that we're going to make a significant dent in shaken baby syndrome or abusive head trauma incidents unless it is implemented systematically in the community. I hope that answers your question.
It looks like Deborah Stewart has a question in regards to whether the information is available for individual parents.
So the quick answer is that it isn't. She says, is it accessible on the web for individual parents
right.
who aren't in place with the program? And the answer is no, that it is not. And again, the reason for this is that in order to be an effective public health prevention program, it needs to be systematically introduced into the communities, at least at a hospital-wide basis. And we have debated, as you can imagine, Deborah, I'm sure, back and forth 1,000 times as to whether or not we should put it on the web, and we've decided not to as a strategy, primarily because if it was available on the web, then we are pretty sure, actually, from a lot of experiences, which I don't have time to talk about, that institutions like hospitals and healthcare systems and departments of public health would say, oh, we don't have to do this, it's on the web, just go there, in which case all kinds of people are not going to get this program. In order to be successful as a public health prevention program, we've got to have community buy-in into this and not just a passive accessing it on the web. So unfortunately, at this point, it isn't on the web. However, there are very important, useful information on the web at this website called purplecrying.info, which expands on the information in the DVD. And so I would recommend that you or whoever wanted to find out more about it try that website.
And Sarah, it looks like there's a question about seeing the video, but I don't know if we have time or not.
Well, if there are no more questions and you just want to finish up, if there are folks who were able to watch it and want to stay on the line for a couple of minutes after we're done, then I can just play it through for them and then close out the session.
Oh, that would be great.
That would be great. And there's some information now on the screen about past training sessions and the Northwest Bulletin. And thank you all for joining us.
All right. Thank you, everyone, and thank you, Dr. Barr. This was a really interesting presentation.
Oh, great. Most welcome.
All right. So I'm going to close out these slides and just open up that video. And if you can't watch it, you're free to sign off by closing out of the window. If you could and you want to stay on for a minute, you can watch this as it plays.
That's what happened with this 20-year-old father who asked us not to reveal his name. We'll call him John. At 16, he was married, and within 2 years, he and his wife had 2 babies. By most accounts, John was a good, loving father who tried hard to care for his new family. But he says he and his young wife became overwhelmed by the expense and responsibility.
Yeah, I'm seeing it. I don't.
It was chaos.
It
was total chaos. Neither one of us was ready for it.
Then one morning, after a heated argument, John's wife stormed out of the house, leaving him upset and alone with their 7-week-old son, Corey.
I couldn't get him to stop crying. No matter what I did, I just could not get him to calm down.
and I took out all my anger and frustrations that I had with my wife and my son. I picked him back forward and I shook him four times like this. And he stopped crying. And I didn't even realize what I had done. He just felt like a little rag doll in my hands. Just like dead weight. There was just no life in him.
Hours later, little Corey was dead, killed by the violent whiplash he suffered at the hands of his father.
I really didn't check him very hard.
We asked John to remember and show us how hard he shook the baby.
Oh, God.
Okay, video is done.
Thank you, Dr. Barr.
Yes, you're most welcome.
It was a good session.
Okay, you bet.
Okay, thanks everyone.